Well, hello everyone. I'm really excited today because I have Cal Newport on the line, and he is the proponent of fixed schedule productivity. He's an MIT postdoctoral student, and he's written several best-selling books in the subject of student success and succeeding in university. So, hey Cal, how's it going?
Hey Scott.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what fixed schedule productivity is and what it's enabled you to do and how this idea came about.
I mean, the idea is straightforward. It's you fix your sort of ideal work schedule first. So, like for me, it was working from 8:30 to 5:30, and then you work backwards from there to make everything else fit into the schedule. And the idea, you know, the motivation behind it was pretty straightforward. It's that we make decisions every day about, you know, when we're going to stop doing work because there's more work in our lives as students or even not as students than you can handle. You can't just sit down and finish and have no work, you know, in your life. There's sort of a never-ending stream. So we all sort of informally make decisions each day, sort of whatever it is, late at night or something, like, okay, I'm just going to stop work for the day. All I'm saying is we should be more explicit about it. And sort of the idea behind it is if you fix, you know, the more idealistic goal, like I want to finish my dinner or something like that, and say, what can I do to make that happen? You'd be surprised by how much you can actually get done in that time. So in some sense, if you explicitly set the goalpost as opposed to just sort of informally deciding each day when to stop working, you'd be surprised by sort of how much less time you actually need to get done what you need to get done.
Okay, great. Now, you've done a lot of research on this idea. Maybe you can give a bit of examples of where you've seen this idea of a fixed schedule of having the constraints put down first before you figure out how you're going to fit them. Maybe you can give some examples of where else you've seen this and how it's been very successful.
Okay, well, one big example I'm interested in is Jim Collins, who is the best-selling author of Good to Great, built the last of these sort of, you know, mega-selling business case study sort of business book Bibles. He did this great profile in the Times earlier this year where he talked about his work habits. And his whole life is built around a fixed schedule productivity mindset. He has this breakdown of what percent of his time he wants to put on thinking and teaching and writing, you know, what percent he wants to put on doing sort of just administrative tasks surrounding being an author, et cetera, et cetera. He sets those percentages, and he actually tracks his time in a spreadsheet and keeps track of on a whiteboard in his Boulder, Colorado office what his current breakdown, how he's using his time, and seeing how far it is from his ideal. But the point about it is that when he set these standards, he had a very small percent of his time that he was willing to put towards the sort of time-consuming stuff that authors do that takes up most of their time, the sort of promotional-related stuff, tweaking their website, and giving talks, and doing social media. So if this fixed schedule is that I only want to spend a very little amount of time on that, and because of that, I mean, if you look at his schedule, what you see is that the bulk of his time, because of his schedule, was spent actually thinking and writing and doing the stuff he likes, and very little was spent doing the sort of promotional stuff. He just does sort of the most important things for the promotion. And he's a sort of wildly successful author who really enjoys his life. And it's like a great example of by fixing his schedule in advance, saying, I want to spend most of my time writing, not, you know, fixing my Twitter profile, and then working backwards to meet it. You know, he still found that he was getting, you know, productive work done, and he was still getting good promotions for his books were still being promoted, but he was in control. So I thought that was a cool example of a field where, you know, different than being students or a freelance worker or something like that, were still fixing their schedule in advance, made these sort of cool results.
So what do you feel is maybe the danger of not using a fixed productivity schedule? What do you find a lot of students are doing, which basically, because they lack this structure, this constraint around their day, what do you find happens?
Well, it's two problems. It's work habits that are more inefficient, and they're sort of strewn throughout with sort of inefficient procrastination activities. So it's a sort of slurry of pseudo-work that sort of sloshes in and out throughout the day until you become too tired to do work anymore. It's sort of a terrible approach to work in some sense. It's very sort of mentally draining and painful. So, for example, when I was a grad student at MIT and I said I wanted to finish work at 5 or 5:30 every day, I mean, well, the first thing that happens is that sort of procrastination happens out the window. There's just no time for that. And secondly, the sort of inefficient, I'm going to sit here in the library with my books and sort of be social and kind of work on it, well, that went out the window, too. There just wasn't time for it. And you actually had to give serious thought to what's the most efficient way to actually finish this assignment and how early am I going to have to start these things to make sure that I don't have to go past 5 on any day. You'd be surprised by, you know, how much wasted time you quickly squeeze a student schedule when you set strict limits.
No, I definitely know what you mean. I think a lot of students suffer from maybe it's more the people I know, but the Facebook trap of you're studying, but what you're really doing is you're on Facebook. And I think that could be applied to a lot of other things. You're in the library, quote unquote, studying, but you're talking with your friends, using the internet, doing whatever. And I think that your idea of fixing it to a certain time basically isolates it so that if you want to do all of those things, that's fine. But you realize that they're going to come after this chunk, which is devoted to work. What else have you noticed from you personally? Have you, from being more rigorous and applying this, how has that affected your stress levels, your ability to get work done?
Well, yeah, one thing interesting I've noticed recently is that I've lost my ability to web surf, basically. I'm no good at it. I can't do it anymore. And the reason is that I have this fixed schedule. When I'm at work, I'm working on my research, you know, and the time is limited, so it's, you know, used very efficiently. It's sort of 2 hours, I'm sort of working on this project, I'm going to switch to this project, I'm going to go for my run, and then I have an hour on this, so it's very efficiently used. So there's no time in there for sort of web surfing, because it doesn't really make sense to be sort of wasting time in the sort of small block of hours I have to work. I say, well, I have plenty of time after I'm done working. I got to work in here to get the stuff done. But because of that, I realized I've lost my ability to web surf. I can't turn on a web browser and sort of entertain myself for more than 5 or 10 minutes, which I think is actually a great testimonial to the effectiveness of this approach. Is that when you have, you know, this time is clearly for work, and I really have to be on the ball in this time to get my work done, you realize how much of the stuff you do now, you're not actually all that interested in doing. It's just not actually all that interesting. So, you know, there's my testimonial. Try this for a semester, and you can find yourself, you know, bored by your computer screen.
Yeah, that is a good testimonial. I think this also ties into another issue that we talked about before, which is that your productivity system, and this is something it's not a new idea, but it should be aimed at getting done not just the little things that pop up on your to-do list every once in a while, but the really important work is going to have a lifetime impact. And you talk about the difference between being hard work and hard-to-do work, in that there's a certain amount of work you need to be putting in effort into basically the sometimes boring pursuit of mastery every single day. How do you find your fixed schedule of productivity allows you to do that?
Right. So this is a big idea that I'm pushing on a lot. I mean, in the context of college, on my website, we call the ideal, the Zen valedictorian ideal, this notion that being very successful in academic settings and have a very successful experience at university can be completely orthogonal to being overworked or stressed or unhappy, right? That they're sort of two separate issues. And then I found the same holds outside of college too, in sort of the professional world. And it comes down to exactly that mistake that you talked about. There's this difference between hard work, which is sort of work where you're very focused on what you're doing, and what you're doing is very hard, and it's pushing your ability sort of right past its limit. It's, you know, what the researchers would probably call deliberate practice, this notion of, like, I'm really focusing all of my attention, pushing my skills on what I'm trying to do here, and I'm getting better at it. That's hard work. Versus hard-to-do work, which is work that spans huge numbers of hours and has you up late at night and is sort of physically very hard on you. So what I've found is that, you know, success in a field or mastery is about consistently doing hard work, right? It's, you know, every day you have to get in there and do some hard work. That's how you get better. But that hard work is not necessarily hard to do, because you only need to do a few hours of that at most each day. That's as much as you can probably handle. So what's great about fixed schedule productivity is that you only have, you know, this sort of small number of hours in your day to actually do your work. So what are you going to fill that time with? Well, what makes sense is that you fill it with, you know, doing hard work on a small number of activities. And what I found is, so I researched this article on the topic that I wrote for Ravid Sethi's blog, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and I went out to find examples of people who are using fixed schedule productivity. So like Jim Collins, but also some entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneurs in particular were having the same experience where the fixed schedule meant that the small amount of time they had each day went to doing sort of hard work, sort of hard focused work on the key things for their business, like trying developing a new product or trying to, say, get new clients on the phone, doing hard sales calls. And what they found is, even though they were spending a lot less hours, their businesses were growing, because what the fixed schedule was forcing them to do sort of the hard work every day, because that's what makes sense when you only have a small amount of time. And with less hours, they were getting more done. And, you know, the same happens at university. If you do the hard work of, like, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm really going to focus on this book, and I'm going to engage these ideas, or I'm really going to sort of get into this problem set with time to spare and really try to understand the concepts, if you're really putting in that hard work every single day, even if it's not taking up a lot of hours, that's what's going to make you sort of a master student. So the fixed schedule productivity kind of forces that, right? You can't afford to spend an hour on Facebook when you only have three lessons in the day.
Exactly. Now, I think what is probably my take from this is that what's more important to fixed schedule productivity isn't setting from 9 to 5 as being hours for work, but that before 9 and after 5 are hours not for work, and that if you can set out a certain chunk of time for work, but if you also allow yourself to work in all the times outside of that chunk, then the barrier kind of loses meaning. So maybe you can talk a little bit about some students I'm thinking are going to want to apply this and say, yeah, it's great, I'll work between these hours, and then they've got something big to crunch for, and they're just going to end up working all day. So how do you handle that kind of difficulty to resist spilling out of the constraint?
Right. It is difficult. I mean, so I've been advising this approach to students for, you know, a few years. In fact, on my blog, if you go back a few years in my archives, there's this series called College Chronicles, where I sort of followed some students as I was giving them advice. And you can see in that series, the particular student from MIT struggling to sort of get a fixed schedule productivity schedule going, right, to have a work endpoint. So it's a practiced art in some sense. But I think what makes it work is the notion that you do good, hard work every single day. And that's actually, it's a different mindset than most students are used to, which is more like you do good, hard work the day before something is due. So it's this sort of, the graph is days without much productive work, but maybe a lot of pseudo work, and then days with lots of hard work, and then days without much work. And it's just sort of up and down graph, which is sort of intermittent and stressful. And what seems to make fixed schedule this sort of clear cutoff work for college students is this notion that, you know, every day you're doing a reasonable amount of hard work in your classes, even if something is not due right away. And that actually works. It can actually prevent things from piling up. Just to give a tactical suggestion for how to do that is, you know, a simple strategy to help bring that to your life is something I call an autopilot schedule, which is this idea that for all of the regular work in your student life, so all of the regular assignments that your classes generate, that you set aside the time each week when you work on that work, as well as the location you go to do that work. So it's just autopilot. Wednesdays from 10 to noon, I'm in the second floor stacks of the biomedical library, you know, tackling my first pass at my problem set for my calculus class, right? It's just sort of automatic thing you do. You like, go to this place, I do hard focus on this work, I know when the time is. That tactic is a great way to sort of ease into the fixed schedule lifestyle, because it's, you know, your regular work is getting done, it's getting done within your schedule, you don't have to make decisions about it. So little tactics like that can make it easier, but the overall thing that makes it work for students is every single day you're doing hard work on your classes, and it prevents the pile from ever growing to a high.
Well, that's a really good point about the consistency of being a system, and I think you actually mentioned this to me before in a different conversation we had, where you believe it's important to have trust in your system. And the way I interpret that being is that you need to develop kind of relationship with your productivity system. It's not so much just injecting, you know, getting things done, or Stephen Covey's system, or reevaluating your mind or yours into your life, and then immediately, bam, it's productive. It's more you need to understand the rhythms of what your productivity system is doing so that you can trust that it's going to get the work done that you need to have it get done, and that you're not going to betray it eventually and decide to work after five just one day because you really need to. Or in my case with the weekly daily goal system where you're going to add more and more work on one day just because you can, and if you betray that trust in the system, then it really kind of crumbles. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that kind of consistency and what you feel trusting your system, what role that plays in the system.
Right. The mind rejects plans that it doesn't think is reasonable. It's just not going to follow it. A big example of that autopilot schedule tactic I just told you about, when I first advise students about it, I say, you will probably fail. This is my experience. You will break your schedule about a half dozen times before you finally get the one that you actually follow. And it'll take somewhere between 4 to 8 weeks of failing and adjusting the schedule and trying again until you actually consistently follow it. And the reason is because when you first try it, it's hard to figure out, okay, what's actually a reasonable amount of time to give to each of these courses and reasonably spread out enough that, like, I could actually follow it. And when you make your first autopilot schedule, you, for example, will not give nearly enough time for a certain type of assignment. So you'll always sort of not finish that time, or you'll be too ambitious. You'll have sort of 5 hours of blocks in a row, and, you know, your mind's like, I'm not going to be able to do 5 hours of work every day. And your mind knows it, and it rebels, and you find yourself not able to, you procrastinate, you don't do your block, you serve the web instead. But when you get the plan right, and it's reasonable, it's enough time to get the work done, it's aligned with your energy rhythms during the day, it's not too much in a row, when your mind finally trusts, like, I think this will work, like, I think I could actually do the work in these blocks and get this big benefit, all those issues with the sort of violating the schedule and procrastinating and not doing what you're supposed to do sort of melt away. So it's not so much this battle with your mind, like, it doesn't want me to get things done and I'm battling it. It's more like it wants me to get things done, but in a way that's reasonable, and it doesn't want to waste time with something that it knows is not going to work. So I always approach these things with this mindset of, like, it's going to take me a month or two of practicing this productivity thing and tweaking it and failing and trying it again and again before I either abandon it or get it to something that can become a more permanent fixture in my life. But I never expect, because it just doesn't match psychology, that, like, I'm going to read the blog post today and tomorrow morning I'm going to have, you know, a new structure in my life that I can be able to follow.
Right, exactly. I think you, for the readers here, or the listeners here who are part of Learning on Steroids, I think they're really going to see this as the 30-day trial method. And you said a month or two, and I think that's probably right, because I've even noticed it myself when I made huge overhauls with the various things. Sometimes they don't stick the first time. I'll commit to doing it for 30 days, and then around day 15, I'll be like, no, this doesn't work. And then I have to reformulate and do it again. So I think that your advice there really applies to a lot of the people who are probably on their 30-day challenges right now or are planning on starting one.
Right. Like, here's a quick example. My current schedule is as follows. I'm up around 6:45 in the morning. At 8, I leave my apartment on Beacon Hill in Boston, and I walk with my dog across the Longfellow Bridge to my office at MIT. I get there around 8:30. I usually spend the first half hour to the hour of my day working on writing if I have a writing project ongoing. Then I switch over to my research until about noon, at which point I will run my dog along the Esplanade, along the Charles River, on a roundabout path back to my apartment, where I'll then drop him off, have lunch, work on my blog for 45 minutes, come back to the office to work the afternoon. And at the very end of the day, I knock off the sort of mosquito tasks, sort of like small tasks you have to do, and then do sort of a formal shutdown of my schedule, look at all my to-dos on the calendar, Air Clan my next day and then shut down my day and leave around 5:30. That's my schedule. I love it. It works really well for me. And it took me 3 months to get that. Right? I mean, so I've had my new job since September 1st, and it wasn't until sometime in November of that I finally landed on this particular structure to my day that actually worked. So there's, you know, 2 or 3 months in the middle there of me every week, like, this isn't working, I need to change this, why don't I move the blog stuff here, I need to, you know. So just as an example, you know, I love my schedule, it works really well for me now, but this wasn't like I woke up one day, what's my ideal schedule, I could just figure it out.
Right, right, exactly. And I think just going on the point, like, you're going to have some adjustment period where you start doing something and if it doesn't feel quite right, like it doesn't feel that like this is hitting you, then you do need to reformulate. And I think you bring up an excellent point, just that you shouldn't expect things to slide into place immediately. But just because they're not sliding into place, that doesn't mean you can't get them to slide into place eventually.
Right, which is what I think is cool about the learning on steroids program. The length is perfect, right? I mean, so it's enough time that you can actually tweak the advice you're giving in these structures to get them actually working in your life. But also, you know, as the time goes on, you're getting sort of new input into the system, new ideas, new advice, which not only gives you new things to work on, but lets you tweak what you've been working on before. And, like, 3 months is sort of that sweet spot that you can come out of that on the other end, not just with new information, but, like, actually having those changes embedded in your student life, which would be much harder to do if you, say, just read a book on it or something like that and hope that starting the next week that you could just put that all into, you know, effect. That probably wouldn't work. So I think that you're on to something with this model of, like, let's continue to work on it over a period of time. You know, it's not just information. It's let's actually do the practice, the action of trying to embed something into your life. I think this model of, you know, working on advice over time is probably a powerful one, at least in terms of results.
Well, thanks. I think that really just what I've been trying to do with this program, and hopefully the listeners here can agree, that I'm trying to model the program closer to how I actually do things in my own life, and I don't do things in a huge concentrated burst, which is sort of represented by a big product release. I do things in a long, steady kind of process with slow input of new ideas and consistent working on those ideas. But just to switch to another point, because this is something that I get a lot of emails from students about, something that I face personally and I notice in a lot of my peers. Here's the situation. Student says, you know what, I like all these ideas. I want to, you know, stop procrastinating and I want to implement some of these ideas. But you know what, I just can't find the motivation to do my classes. And that's sort of the underlying word, big and looming like a monster, but I can't find the motivation. So I know you have some thoughts on this. What are you going to say to a student who feels they just don't have that drive to change things at the plate?
Yeah, so there's the big picture philosophy I have about college life and even beyond. This is sort of, you know, at the top of my blog, for example. There's this notion that if you want a college experience where you are motivated and engaged and are successful but also enjoy your life, sort of my motto is that you need to be doing less things, you need to be doing those things very well, and you need to know why you're doing them in some sense. And most college students do the opposite. They do as many things as possible, just well enough that it's sort of passable behavior. They're barely getting the grades they need, usually, and with no idea why they're doing it, just because they blindly feel like, in some sense, the more I do, the better, and college is somehow a good thing for me to do, and I'm just doing it. That's, like, really hard. That's a really hard approach to anything. It's very hard to keep up your motivation. I mean, you have to either have really demanding parents or, like, a really, you know, high diligence threshold to get through 4 years based on I'm just trying to do as much stuff as possible for no real reason I can identify. You know, that's tough. That's definitely tough. So, you know, when students write me with this, like, I'm overwhelmed and I can't find the motivation, give me the tactics that are going to help me get over this issue, I say, you know, forget the tactics first. Like, it's the big picture thing. do much less of these things, do them much better, be excellent in your major, be excellent in the one extracurricular that you really want to devote your time to, and know why you're doing it in some sense. Have some sense of why you are at college, right? You have an answer to that question. This is what I'm trying to get out of college, right? This is why I'm here, and I believe in that, you know, that answer, and I'm going to do a small number of things really, really well and support that answer, and that's, you know, so it's structural in some sense. So when someone comes to me with those motivational problems, I say, well, before we get into the to-do list format, let's think about, like, how you're structuring your life. Let's think about why you're here, you know, the big questions. There were a lot of, I think, college students, it's the first time they've had to face that, which can be scary, but I think it's also exciting. You know, it's an exciting time to look at those issues.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. No, I think another thing that we talked about before, we've actually had a little bit of a back and forth in your blog, is that this motivation issue, and this is partially the fault of bloggers and writers who use word excessively, but a lot of this motivation is tied into the subject of passion. Are you passionate about your subject? Actually, I know a lot of students who, like, some of them are really, really interested in their subject. Some of them are just, you know, maybe I'm not cut out for this. I really don't like this course. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, you and I have had interesting back and forth on this on our blog. But the way I approach passions, and this is it's a little bit hyperbolic, but I think it's useful for the situation, is to say basically forget them, right? From my experience, passion is more something that people use to describe something that they've already put in a lot of time into, have already mastered, have already made an important part of their life. It doesn't describe a sort of a priori feeling towards things out there, right? So I'm saying if you're a sophomore in college, you probably have no passions, right? Don't look for what am I passionate about, because I see passions as how people who have already invested a lot of time feel about it, right? So forget trying to look for this magic passion, this magic feeling that, like, when you find the right major, you're just going to immediately feel like, oh, this is it, this is what's meant for me. Because there is no a priori passions. That's something you earn, right? Find something that you have some interest in. I don't care if it's, you know, because you watched a TV show and it inspired you or whatever. It doesn't really matter. Find something you have some interest in, even if vague, and put your chips down on the table for that bit. Say, I'm going to keep my skills pretty clear. I'm going to invest my time in this. I'm going to become, you know, remarkable at it in my time that I'm in college. And then by the time you graduate, you'll probably look back and say, oh, I'm passionate for it, right? Because it's the feeling you have once you've already mastered it. But if you're a sophomore or a freshman, don't sweat passion. They don't exist. You're not going to find them. You know, pick something and work on, you know, becoming remarkable at it. You know, and worry less about, you know, what's the right thing out there. Because that's the question I don't think you're ever going to find it into.
No, I actually completely agree with the approach of putting the mastery of something before the stumbling upon something. And I think the best example is just if you're working on a subject and you're not doing well at it, you don't feel, and it's not even about getting good grades, because I don't think, yes, grades are important depending on what you're doing, but it's not about getting good grades. It's not even about, like, someone says, oh, you're really, really good at this. I think it's more of an internal thing. When you're working on something and you're getting it, when you're working on a subject and you're sort of getting the answers, or you're figuring out how it all interrelates, and that sort of getting it, being good at it, creates its own sort of reward system. And I've noticed that for myself, is that there's a strong correlation between the courses that I like the most and the courses that I do the best at. And if there are, of course, some, like, minor deviations, so as you said, it's maybe a bit of an exaggeration to say that's the only thing that matters to be passionate, but I wouldn't say it's an exaggeration to say it's the major thing, or even the thing that you should be focusing on. So for a lot of students who are stuck in this kind of, I would almost say kind of a motivation catch 22, is that they're working at something and they don't have any motivation to do it, but they don't realize that they have to put the effort in order to get the passion, which creates that kind of intrinsic drive. So I think you're right. You have to kind of just pick something that interests you a bit, and see maybe a path after university through, or even in university, and put your chips down. You have to put your chips down and focus on it. And one of the reasons that I've created this program is because I'm hoping to give people some tools that they can get a bit better at getting quote unquote, getting the subject they're working on. Because I think that getting it, that being good at it, is part of the reason that creates the motivation. I think it is a good feedback cycle to get into when you're working it. And a lot of people who say, I'm really passionate about something, they're really working that feedback cycle, that the more energy they invest into it, the better feedback they get, and that leads back to them as being more motivation to do it again the next time.
Right. Yeah, you never find, for example, you never find a blogger with 100 subscribers who says, oh, I'm so passionate about blogging, but you come back later when they've built it to a few thousand, and then you're going to hear and be like, this is the passion of my life, it's important. It's because they got good at it. So there's no one with the followers. But I think there's an important additional point to that that is specifically relevant to college students' philosophy. There's this worry, and I'm sure you get this a lot, Scott, that when you tell a student this idea, they'll say, well, wait, I can't just choose whatever, some superficial interest, and just say I'm going to major in this, because I have to think about, like, what job that's going to make available, what's that going to mean for my future. There's the sense that these choices are somehow, you know, predicting what you'll be doing after college. And I think the most important idea that to maybe give about that very particular fear is what I call the ability hypothesis. And it's this notion that the world rewards and is fascinated by stars, right? So if you put your chips down in art history and become a star in the art history department, right? I'm going to argue that for almost any type of job you're going to try to get afterwards, the fact that you are a star in that department and the sort of awards you got because of that and opportunities you got from that and publications and the recommendations professors write, that's going to get you much farther, much more respect from the world than just, you know, hey, I had, you know, this practical major, I did double major, and I got pretty good grades in it, and I did a lot of activities that, you know, being a star, regardless of what it is in, is like an incredibly powerful currency. So I sort of use that to alleviate students' fears that, you know, it really matters what they choose. I say, what matters is if you can become a star. It doesn't matter if it's art history or computer engineering. You know, people want to work with stars. People want to hire people who have the capability of being a star because they figure, hey, they can replicate that, you know, at my company or my startup or whatever.
Right, exactly. And you know what? I've actually talked about this. I wrote an article a few years ago, in fact, where basically the subject of the argument was that I was talking to someone and their big fear, and unfortunately they weren't doing that well. They were 26, they had a lot of intelligence and ambition, but they were still working minimum wage jobs, and they basically said, like, I'm very unhappy with what I'm doing right now. I don't know what I want to do with my life. I just know it's not this. And I think that the problem, and there's other factors, of course, but the problem I see in that kind of situation, and even a lot of other students, is that they're really looking for a top-down approach to answering with really big questions. I just don't think there is one. I don't think there is a way you can say, okay, well, this is exactly what I'm going to do, and then I have to do this, and this before it, and it's going to lead up to that. And, you know, that might work for some careers. Like, if you're 100% sure you want to be a dentist, well, there's a pretty clearly defined path for dentistry. But for most of the really interesting lifestyles, really interesting careers, there isn't a very clear path. Or if there is a clear path, there's a lot of different strategies you can take to going about it. So my approach is more of a bottom-up approach, where you figure out, okay, I have some interest in these kind of things, pick one of them, and it's basically just a spark at this point, and your whole goal is to turn it into a bonfire. So as you said, you're putting your chips into it to make this little thing, which is not really that great, significant, into something big that you can have that ability, have, as you say, be a star at it. And because people want to hire people who have bonfires, people want to work at businesses for entrepreneurs that are bonfires, having that kind of ability to take a spark and turn it into something a lot bigger is, in my opinion, a much more important skill than being able to divine where you should be going in your career based on some hypothetical top-down strategy.
Yeah, right. I call it the mythology of the primacy of choices or something, right? This idea that pervades so so much of the career literature that by far the most important steps of sort of turning around something you don't like and making a life you love is the choices you make. That's what you have to choose. You know, I'm going to choose the right career, choose the right field. That's the key to finding happiness. And it just doesn't match what happens in reality. There's no magic choice. If I just switched over to this career, that, you know, if I could just identify and switch over to it, then like everything would be better. You know, it doesn't work that way. And if you look at what is it when people like imagine, dream, start a career settings, or find someone whose situation they really admire. Those jobs usually have some of the same features, right? Autonomy, usually some sort of flexibility, you know, and like when you work or how you work, which kind of goes along with autonomy. It uses your skills and earns you recognition and usually some sort of pretty good compensation. Like sort of all of the things that people dream about sort of have these sort of these attributes. And the question is, well, we'll think about that for a second. Those are very desirable attributes. So how are you going to get those? Well, you know, that's going to have to be a reward for you having some sort of skill that is both rare and very valuable to the world, right? Because otherwise, everyone would have jobs like that. Everyone desires it. So to me, I think less, you know, as you're saying, think less about, you know, what am I going to choose to do? And think more about what rare and valuable skill do I have that I can sort of cash in for the attributes that I want in my job. And when most people look at their situation, they say, well, I don't have any. So the next question is, okay, well, what is a rare and valuable skill that I can start developing, right? But it's a primacy of what you have to offer, primacy of skill versus primacy of just choice, you know, primacy of figuring out what to do. So for that young man you talked about sort of in the situation, I don't know what I want to do in my life, but it's not this. Well, you know, his secret's not finding the right thing. It's saying, like, well, I don't have any rare and valuable skills. What's something that I'm at least superficially interested in that I could invest time in to make into a rare and valuable skill? It's a different way of looking at things, and it requires more hard work than just, you know, having the courage to quit your job and choose the right next job. But I think it's kind of empowering because you sort of trust that might actually work. Like, you know what, if I did build up whatever skill X, which is really valuable, I actually believe that, you know, I could get to these things in my life that I'm sort of desiring, where we don't necessarily trust, you know, that, well, I don't know, just quitting my job and going to start the surf shop or whatever, you know, the easy fix solution is. We don't really trust, is that really going to work? Mm-hmm. Am I going to be on welfare? Is this really going to make money? So it's a different way of looking at things, but it's an idea that I'm increasingly more interested in.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Just as a little side note, I had a conversation with my friend made a little while ago, and my personal theory is that the people who have the most interesting jobs and the most interesting lives, it's directly correlated with if you figure out what they're doing to make money, and then figuring out what their undergraduate degree is, if the further those two things are apart, usually the more interesting their job is. And I'm usually relating that to the idea that this is the kind of person that didn't have a top-down style of picking which choice they're going to do. They kind of followed more your approach, where they got into a field, developed some skill really well, and then that skill itself, kind of independent of maybe the educational choice they made, is what enabled them to have this really interesting career, which everybody outside of it is like, how'd you get that job? So maybe it's just a little side note, but just to sort of pull back a little bit, going back to productivity, because we sort of broadened out from the global ideas of success and pursuing your passion, and I want to get back to maybe how you feel that a bottom-up strategy or a sort of picking something and focusing on a strategy, how does that fit in with maybe fixed schedule productivity? How does that fix in on a tactical level on your day-to-day action?
Right, well, if the first thing you do, and this is the advice I give most often to college students, is quit lots of things, then turn your attention to, so that's the do less part of my philosophy, then turn your position to the do better, right? Be smarter about how you do that work. But you've just made that productivity task, that tactical task, so much easier. You know, if it's like I have one major with a reasonable course load, and I have maybe one extracurricular activity that I put any sort of significant time into, well, you just simplified your sort of landscape of tasks. And now it's much easier than the structure that's we have a reasonable course load. It's much easier to have an autopilot schedule that gives you plenty of time to like handle all the work in these classes well in advance. You know, you have plenty of time to refresh and relax each night, so then it's much easier to be motivated the next morning when you're going to the library to do this sort of work. So I think they're really connected. If you do the top-down thing of simplifying your life, then the bottom-up of handling your life's demands efficiently can just be, you know, exponentially an easier process.
I think you're absolutely right. I wrote an article recently talking about what I feel the obvious solutions to becoming more productive are, because everybody likes to talk about the hacks and the techniques. You know, and I'm guilty of that. I think you're both guilty of that, because those are the things that are the easiest to control. It's easy to say, you know, organize your day like this, do your tasks like this, and get them done. It's a lot harder to say something like, well, you know, if you want to get all done, the fastest way to do it is to simply to do less things. So, the example I use for the business I'm running, I get those done when I'm working on it full time. That's the number one factor. Like, it doesn't matter whether, you know, I'm using this type of system to do it, because that's just sort of the 20%. The 80% is, am I working on it as a big focus? And so I think a lot of students get focused on that 20%, which is the right tools. I even fixed schedule productivity as an example of like having the right tools to get all those things done. But the real 80% is, as you said, it's the first thing. It's just getting rid of all the stuff, focusing down on the things that are really important, that matter to what you're putting your chips into. So I completely agree on that front.
Yeah, I think, you know, David Allen basically sort of captured 20 years ago everything you really need to know about that 20%, which is, you know, you want to make sure that everything is captured and regularly reviewed so that you're not stressed and you don't have things bouncing around in your mind. Yeah. Beyond, I mean, that's what productivity systems are for. That things are captured and you review them regularly and make plans so that you're not being stupid about your time and you're not stressed. But that's all it is, you know, and you can tweak that, but that's only going to get you so far, right? So you're right, that's the 20%, and you figured that out a long time ago. So figure out how to do that in a way that works for you, and then the rest of your time should be, you know, hard focus on a small number of things. You know, it's a pretty easy formula, but it's surprisingly hard to sort of convince people to go after it.
And I think this is one thing that I brought up. We have slightly different views on this, but one thing that I find, just both for my own life and noticing in other people's, that it's very difficult for people who have kind of a, I would almost say a schizophrenic approach to doing things. If they want to be doing this, and the other thing, to really, like, well, how do I pick one exactly? And I think that the big thing is, and what I've really done in my life is you need to pick one thing, and that's what your system encompasses. So, well, like, if not one thing, a very small number of things. So, for example, for me, it's courses and running this business is that system. All of my productivity, all that kind of stuff, just encompasses making sure those two things are handled. And then if you have extracurriculars on the side, like you're doing something else, as long as those things just, you don't put any force into getting them done, and I think that they're not necessarily the people. So, for example, if you're interested in learning something else, maybe you have it in your sheet, but there's no guilt in like, oh, I need to be doing this. And I think that the difference is having interests and having commitments. And you can have multiple interests, but you really need to just have those one or two commitments, because that's really what drives your time and your work. Because, you know, that's really, the interests are going to be made up of your leisure time if you want to use them, and if you're overworked and they're just going to fall off, and that's fine.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I often advise, I think that the interest and commitment split is really smart, right? I mean, have interests, have hobbies, have things that, you know, get you with around people doing social stuff. You know, like I play guitar and I'm interested in craft beer brewing and like photography. Yeah, those are all interests, right? but they're not commitments. When I think of a commitment, I think something that requires a regular investment in park focus. And that's where you can be completely very selective. And I often advise colleges, take your time, right? I mean, we're trying to choose like an extracurricular pursuit that you want to make a commitment, put real hard focus into. Don't force it. If you don't want, you know, spend a semester just exposing yourself to stuff. If something of, you know, seems like, oh, this seems really good, this seems interesting, this seems, you know, worth exploring or something like that. I mean, there doesn't have to be this fear of, like, I have to choose something right now. You can take your time on that, just sort of exposing yourself to things. I mean, there's something nice about being able to do that. That you're just reading and going to talk and meeting people and sort of attending club meetings that don't really require you to do anything but attend club meetings. That's all fine, you know. But yeah, I think you're completely right. I subscribe to the rule of three. There's more than three major commitments in your life. Right? If you're a student, courses is one of those. So now you're down to two. Yeah. Now you have two things outside of courses that you can choose to put any sort of major hard focus on. So yeah, if you want to take your time, you know, do so.
I think that this also kind of this commitment interest would also come down to something else that we've sort of talked about before, which maybe we kind of depart from the norms of this sort of writing community, is that we both kind of feel that getting started is not the most important step in becoming good at anything, despite the claims of a lot of other authors that, you know, all you really need to do is get started, and getting started is so important, like the art of the start, that kind of stuff. I feel that if you put, it's sort of a natural correlation, the more emphasis you put on getting started, then by necessity, you're also putting a little bit less emphasis on being committed. And honestly, I think that it's the being committed that is what's really important, and being committed to one thing for a long period of time, long enough that you can start to see some real results of it, is what really matters. So maybe you can weigh in with your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and this new book I'm writing, it's coming out in the summer, so it's something that's sort of on my mind now because I just finished the manuscript. I coined, like, actually a method. I love calling things methods, but the method I coined in this book was what I call the advice guide method. That the idea is, if you are interested in making something a major commitment, something you want to become really good at, what you should think about doing first, the thing that you should get started on, is, in essence, writing an advice guide on how to do what you're about to do, right? That's a good way of thinking about it. So you want to write a book, or you want to, you know, sell a screenplay, or start a business, or something like that. Your goal should be like, I want to go out there and get enough information that I feel like I could write like a how-to book on how to do it. Because as we've talked about before, you had actually, the day we're recording this, which is in early December, you had a good blog post on this idea. This notion that knowledge, that real deep understanding of how the field works, is gonna give you more motivation in the long term than any sort of like sense of excitement or pumping yourself up or, you know, motivational, you know, little sayings or something like that. But this notion that if you really understand the field, but how people become good at that field, that makes the difference in the sort of long-term commitment. That's really what seems to make, you know, what matters. So, yeah, that's why I think that's where that hesitancy comes from. Like, well, don't just jump into writing the book. Jump into figuring out how people sell books like the type that you want to write, if you're actually serious about it.
I think this kind of, part of my resistance to completely going around that idea is that another problem some people do face is getting into analysis paralysis, where they spend all this time researching and not enough time doing it. I don't think it's as big a problem as many people claim it is. But my basic situation is that start doing some work, not like you're fully into the commitment, but you start doing something, so you're actually making some headway. But while you're doing that, as you said, you do a non-trivial amount of research, as you said, enough that you feel you could write an advice guide on how to do it. And not only does that research help make your plans and adjust what you're actually working on, but I think that really fills you with a lot more motivation, a lot more commitment, because you feel you can actually do it. So this is a small example of something that happened. About 5 years ago, I decided to become a vegetarian, and that's a fairly big change. You're going from meat all the time. Actually, when I initially did it, it was to go to strict vegetarian, where I wasn't eating eggs or milk either. So that's a pretty big change going from eating a lot of meat products. So what I did is, not only did I start doing it for a month, but a little bit before and during the full month I was focusing on, I read several books on being a vegetarian and sort of not only the benefits of it, but how to do it, like recipes, that kind of stuff. And all of this extra research really made the scaffolding of the pursuit I was doing. And I think if I had just done that, just on sort of a whim, I probably would have given up after a month just because, you know, it's not really, it's a lot of work. You have to differently, and, you know, sometimes it's, you go through a bit of withdrawal with some of the things. It's not really that good. But if you have all of this scaffolding of, like, you know what, I can actually do this. This is actually good for me, blah, blah, blah. Then it can really last. And I know that because I'm still a vegetarian today and it continues. So I think if your process of applying research as sort of a joint strategy when you get started, and a non-trivial amount of research too, not just reading one or two blog articles, but doing a lot of serious research, is a good strategy to really sink in that commitment. And yeah. Instead of just dabbling in things, which a lot of people do.
I think sort of this research paralysis idea, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I mean, from my experiences, if you're doing this research, if this pursuit is actually a good pursuit for you, something that, like, you'll probably succeed at if you do it right and sort of something you're excited about, the research will get you chomping at the bit to start, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's going to make you more motivated, this is my experience, than you were before. If, on the other hand, this was not really a good idea, the odds are long, or it's not necessarily a good fit for what you're doing, then as you're doing more and more research, you're going to find, you know, your motivation waning. That's a good thing, right? I think that's it's a great test as to whether or not this is something worth putting a lot of time into. Do the research. If you find yourself like, I can't wait to get started, the more you do the research, do it. If you find yourself paralyzed, great, you know, move on, right? I mean, this notion that, like, it doesn't matter what you do, just jump in, you know, that is overrated. As an example, like, when I was writing this book, I tried to give a few guidelines for, like, okay, how do you have to do this research? And I was like, well, a good rule of thumb is find examples of people who failed at what you're doing, find examples of people who succeeded, figure out what the differences are between the two, and then try to actually contact one of the successful examples and get their personal, you know, advice on it, right? So as an example for the book, I said, I'm going to pretend to be a student who's interested in starting a blog about, like, financial stuff, like Ramit's blog. So what I did is I found a bad financial advice blog, you know, young person financial advice blog that had no readers, and then I compared it to J.D. Roth's success, you know, phenomenally successful Get Rich Slowly blog, and I very quickly saw what the differences were. Oh, he writes these type of posts, where this guy was doing this sort of stuff. And then I sent J.D. an email pretending to be, you know, a student interested in writing these blogs, and I got back a response from him with all this advice on do this, don't do this. And this was just supposed to be, you know, an example, but I found myself getting, like, excited, like, you know what, I could start a pretty big financial blog, you know? Like, I was feeling, you know, I had that feeling that, like, I could commit to this in the long run. If I follow this advice, I could probably have a really big, you know, readership here. And even though I have no actual reason for me to do that. But the point being, yeah, this sort of research paralysis thing, I think, is a myth. I think if it's a good idea for you, the research is going to get you more motivated. And if it doesn't, move on.
No, definitely. I think you're absolutely right that if there's this sort of myth around that doubts that you might have are wrong or a bad thing, and I think that's kind of ridiculous. Like, if you have doubts about something, usually, there are exceptions, but usually, there's a good reason you have doubts about it. And I think it's better to work with those doubts or channel them then to try to, you know, just ignore them, which is sort of a popular mantra right now.
Yeah, it's a survivorship bias, right? I mean, people who are very successful look back at their path to being successful, and they say, well, if I had had doubts or not had started down this path, then I would have been successful. That's the survivorship bias. You're not hearing, no one writes books about, you know, here's, you know, my project I started that I failed on because it wasn't really a good fit for me. You know, you don't hear from them. So it's like a lottery winner being like, hey, the key to becoming a millionaire is buying lottery tickets, right? If I hadn't bought lottery tickets, I would have been a millionaire. Yeah, it doesn't mean that that's necessarily, like, the best strategy.
And I think you bring up a really good point because you mentioned researching cases of people who didn't do well as well as the cases who did well. And I think that the cases that didn't do well are a really good test for two reasons. One, when you talk to people that either had a lot of struggle or failed through a process, you get that worst case scenario in your head, because I think if you focus relentlessly on the best case, what's going to be good, what's going to happen, then a lot of your fears about, like, can I actually do this, is it going to, you know, is it going to be strange, will sort of nag at you, and you won't really know what they are. Tim Ferriss talks about how when he decided to basically quit his business and travel around the world for 18 months, living in Argentina, the thing that got him to do it wasn't, look at all these benefits I could get from doing this. It was, what's the worst that could possibly happen if I do this? And once you know that, it's better to sort of accept it and reason with it. So I think that that's one advantage, is that if you know sort of what are the failure cases, then you can kind of sort of be more on terms with, like, you know, if this completely goes wrong, then, you know, this is still like an outcome that, that is possible. The other thing that I think working with or looking at failure cases can help with is they can also sort of give you a bit of an insight into, sort of maybe, like, as you said, some of the differences between them and the successful people. I've looked at a lot of people when I was starting blogging who kind of didn't have great blogs. They've been blogging for a while, but it was pretty small. And contrasting their approach from really successful blogging, one of the most obvious things was the amount of work that was put in. And that really gave me an indication, okay, well, these blogs are really successful, but if you compare them to the bulk of blogs that are sort of at the bottom, and the amount of workload difference, especially in the early phases between these two approaches, it's clear that I need to put in at least this much amount of work if I want to have a successful blog. So I think if you're looking at other, as a student, looking at other learners or other people in your prospective career, that's something that's really good. And looking at the working gap or the networking gap, like how much time do they spend, like, trying to connect with people in this business or industry, or how much time do they spend doing this? Those are really good benchmarks until you need to figure out exactly what's necessary to do well and work with people.
Absolutely. Completely agree on that. I mean, why, I never get why people write entire nonfiction book manuscripts without taking a half hour to talk with an agent, for example. An agent that buys those type of books and be like, what would someone have to do to sell a book with my idea? Like, why, you know, why people think it's better to spend 6 months, writing for hours and hours as opposed to spending a half hour to just ask, what would I have to do to actually properly sell this to a publisher, you know, which can send you off in a completely different direction, and it's sort of this resistance to it I don't understand, but knowing the battle you face makes it so much easier to fight and sort of going in with blindfolds on.
And I think one of the things that you brought up, which is especially important to me, is that there's a difference between doing this cursory, I would almost say literature research, and actually talking to someone who's done it.
Yeah.
So, For blogging, for example, one of the mistakes I made is I read a lot of articles and big technical blogs on how to make a successful blog, but I didn't spend as much time actually writing a successful blog and just asking for a bit of advice. Sometimes their advice is going to be the same as what's been written around there, but often you'll get a much more rich and detailed approach to whatever you're doing when you actually talk to someone who's done it before. Because it's one thing to get the sales pitch or, like, how to publish a book in 6 steps, read that. It's another thing to talk to an author who's actually done it, relate your experience, and just kind of get the emotions almost of how they feel you're approaching it, because that's worth 10 times as much in literature you can read on the topic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree. There's this sort of myth, I guess you call it the hard to do work myth, or in some sense just this notion that all that really matters is, like, you put a lot of effort towards something and that the world will reward you. Whereas, you know, all the research literature on how people become good at things or exceptional at things, they're like, no, it has to be the right type of work, right? If you got to do, put work in the right areas, get good at the right things, you have to have, not only do you have to do this hard focus, but you have to have professional feedback on what you're doing to help redirect where you're putting this focus. So it's actually, you know, very hard to apply the effort in the right way. So to jump into something without talking to people, you know, in the field is like training for an athletic event without any sort of professional coaching on the best way of doing it. It's, you know, it's inefficient, the chances you're going to get good are low, and, you know, the rate at which you do it's going to be slow, you know. The training metaphor is a good one. That if you're attacking something blind, it's sort of like a foolhardy approach.
Right. Well, thank you for coming on the interview, Cal. There's lots of advice there. I really suggest that anybody who's feeling that they have a lot to handle in their courses, look at some of your writing at StudyPacks. That's calmreport.com/blog. Go there, read his articles. There's great information on for students and for studying. Thanks for sharing both fixed schedule productivity, your approach to finding career choices, and all of that.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me to do this, Scott. I always feel like I learn a lot the more I actually talk about all the stuff I write about. I come away from our conversations with more ideas than I started, so it's a lot of fun.